I haven't been thinking about the failures of social democracy as much as I've been thinking about the failure of the left after World War II, or the failure of the left after a crisis. And I have some things to say about that with involving CLR James and Cornelius Castriotis and Grace Boggs, I think this is a third member of Facing Reality. But we don't have to get to that first. I feel like I should give you an opportunity to jump in right off the bat with what you're thinking about with when it comes to the failures of social democracy.
Yeah, I mean, it starts off with the failures of social democracy and turns into the failures of the Marxist left as a whole. But it really, honestly, it's a perfect pivot to what you're talking about, because this set of failures leads to the second set of failures that you want to talk about, because it's in this time period that any living memory of Marx is lost. And I know that feels really late, but, you know, Kautsky knew Marx, Kautsky knew Hilferding, Hilferding knew Lenin. I mean, like, so there was still almost apostolic lines of succession going back to the man. And that's all gone by the end of this. And the other thing I'm realizing is, like, the tendency to kind of throw out parts of Marxism or Marxist ideas that you don't like, not even based on, like, contradictions of Marx or whatever, it's almost immediate. It only takes Engels dying for it to happen. Like it's and in some ways it was happening even when Marx and Engels were alive, but you had Engels to correct people. But you know, this is mainly the story of Rudolf Hilferding and how he inadvertently came up with one of the most important innovations in the theories of Karl Marx, and then used it to drag the SPD into the ground kind of accidentally. The big book that what's fascinating about Hilferding is he becomes a Marxist economist late in life. And he was a member of the independent Social Democratic Party, but when they made four ways into reconciling with the early Communist Party, and they attended the Second Congress of the Comintern in 1920. He goes back into the SPD, but his history before that's even fascinating. So, what his main innovation was he stepped in to debate Bohm von Buerk in the crisis debate. And
so he was a great defender of Marx against a right-wing critic.
Right. What he says is actually the business cycle doesn't lead to a final crisis, but it actually leads to increased monopolization in terms of financialization. Right. And his work, Finance Capital, is where the theory of monopoly capital really comes from. And what's interesting about this is that leads to Lenin and Bukharin really developing their ideas of imperialism based off of competition, competition in finance to hide the declining rates of profits. And if this sounds familiar to, like, say, Kleinman's thesis about the 1970s, it's because it is. And that led to, you know, imperialism, which we talked about many years ago, about how that was pretty accurate for the time, but because Hilferding wasn't focusing on any of the, you know, the former settler colonies, he completely didn't see America and all that throwing the balance off. So he becomes a doctor in 1893, joins a bunch of students. And becomes a socialist early on. He knows Max Adler. He meets Otto Bauer, and then he meets Kautsky pretty early on, and August Bebel. And August Babel asked him to quit being a podiatrist because he was educated as a doctor, and start writing, and start working with the SPD on developing an economic policy. Carl Kasky had met him in 1902 and read some of his economic work, thought it was brilliant, and started asking him to write for the New Time, which was one of their major newspapers, the Social Democrats' major newspapers, in 1902. So he really starts developing Marx's economic theories. In 1902, he writes the big review of Bombeau work and kind of refutes it. He also starts talking about the general strike as a political weapon. And he starts a study group that really becomes the foundation of what is now known as Austro-Marxism, which is, you know, often liked because it's kind of separate from the main line of revisionism that you start seeing with Bernstein and also from Bolshevism. In World War One.
Is anti-revisionism simply Bolshevism?
You see, what's funny about that, anti-revisionism actually, it doesn't really have anything to do with the Bernstein revisionism debate. It has to do with them kind of tarring Khrushchev with the idea that adding humanism back into Marxism was the same as the Bernstein revisions. So it's they're not directly related, except in so much that one is actually an implicit tar of the USSR in the 1950s.
It's the fucking Marxist fault for making it this way, but just because we keep, like any other religious sect, we keep going back to the original text and then bringing it forward and changing its meaning.
Right, exactly. And we also keep doing this thing where like these crucial pivotal points in like the first and second generations are super huge, and we just kind of replay them over and over again. except by the time it comes down now, like we've forgotten that was the context for all of this. Like,
do you ever see the really crappy Star Trek episode where they land on a planet where there's a war going on between the Yangs and the Khams? And the Yangs bring out this document that's a copy of the Declaration of Independence, but they read it all wrong.
No.
I might run a clip of it.
No, no. Only the eyes of a chief may see the E Plebnista.
This was not written for chiefs.
Hear me. Hear this! Among my people, we carry many such words as this from many lands, many worlds. Many are equally good and are as well respected. But wherever we have gone, no words have said this thing of importance in quite this way. Look at these three words written larger than the rest, with a special pride never written before or since. Tall words proudly saying, we the people. That which you call Eid Plebnista was not written for the chiefs or the kings or the warriors or the rich or the powerful, but for all the people. Down the centuries, you have slurred the meaning out of the words, we, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty. Posterity to ordain and establish this Constitution. These words and the words that follow were not written only for the Yangs, but for the Khams as well.
The Khams?
They must apply to everyone, or they mean nothing. Do you understand?
I do not fully understand. One named Kirk. But the holy words will be obeyed.
So what's interesting is he starts writing economic history stuff and for August Babel in Berlin. And he, you know, but he actually can only do it for a year because German law forbids teachers without German citizenship. So he gives up his job to Rosa Luxemburg. And until 1915, he basically is a foreign editor of the SPD's newspaper. And in that time period, from when he tried to teach for the SPD, tried to teach economics for them, to the time period where he steps down as the SPD's major newspaper editor, Howard Bartz, he releases the Finance Capital Study, which takes the ideas that he started developing to defend Marx against von Behrwerk. And he writes this huge, major thing about how financialization and monopolization was following trends on Das Kapital, and it was going to be geopolitically destabilizing. And then he also starts working for the Socialist International, the Second International, and really becoming their leading like economic thinker. So he actually interestingly, Lenin still liked him in the 1910s because in the debate he wasn't silent like Kautsky was. You know, Kautsky had that operational vote where he refused to take a side in the internal debate. And then we don't, everything's hidden because of democratic centralism. Well, Hilferding opposes the war bonds and any support for the war effort immediately. He was one of the only ones to formally vote against the, because a lot of people abstained, but he formally voted against. He actually, in the editorship in 1915, this is why he no longer was the editor, but at that point, signed a declaration opposing the war policies. But interesting enough, he actually served in the war because he had medical training and was Austrian. He ends up drafted into the Austro-Hungarian army and serves as a medic. So he gets, some combat valor. And he's still operating off he's still operating off all this stuff in the early 1918. He participates in the November Revolution. He's a part of the Independent Social Democratic Party of Germany, which was that thing that Bernstein and Kautsky and all the anti-war people who didn't join the communists. Are the Spartacus Burn went into, and since the Spartacus Burn was killed by the SPD, he stays in the USPD or the Independent Social Democrats, which I think in another podcast I called the United Social Democrats because I mistranslated the title. He does that until 1920. In 1920, though, or 1919, he starts hearing. In 1918, Ebert uses troops to suppress riots in Berlin, which have nascent communists in them. And Ebert, who's the head of the SPD, is supposed to have a cordial relationship, kind of united front relationship with the Independent Social Democratic Party, but he doesn't consult them. So then the USPD removes its representatives from the Social Democratic government, which starts like all these splits. This gets worse and worse. And Hilferding actually supports the workers' councils, with the Spartzburn. He wrote articles, however, about how the workers' council should be implemented, and Lenin criticized them, basically that they were too democratic. And Hilferding started like having major disputes with the Bolsheviks, and he opposes the October Revolution formally, particularly after correspondence with Molotov, Martov doesn't oppose the October Revolution, but Martov is the split with Martov is what leads Lenin to actually formally split with the Mensheviks. Just as a side note for our listeners, because this is getting deep in history. So all this time, Lenin picks up his theories that monopolization was going to lead to international conflict. They've already seen it happen in World War One.
Just to be clear, you're kind of jumping around in time here, aren't you?
Yeah.
You're not going in a straightforward
timeline. I'm going kind of in a straightforward timeline, but I'm having to backtrack to get this some things. So we're at 1920.
So he opposed the October Revolution before he broke with Kautsky and the, if I'm tracking this right.
The thing is, he opposed the October Revolution before he broke with the Independent Social Democrats, which doesn't really happen until 1922. In 1920,
But when was that riot?
1919.
The Social Democrats? Right. So that was after he opposed the October Revolution.
Right. Yes.
Right. So I'm just trying to put this in a straightforward timeline. So, okay. So why did he oppose the October Revolution?
He opposed the October Revolution in Russia because he thought that Lenin was going to be anti-democratic and suppress the Workers' Council.
Oh, because it was a worker, because of the criticism he'd received about the workers' councils.
So he had sided with the Sparks, even though he didn't join them, but he was on their side in that revolution.
But the Sparks supported the October Revolution.
Correct. He had sided with the Sparks in Germany, but against the October Revolution. So you can already tell he's carving out a very niche position. In 1920, the Independent Social Democrats go to the Comintern and meet with, you know, the Bolsheviks. In 1922, they suggest merging the Independent Social Democrats with the Communist Party. This doesn't happen, but it's enough to lead to a lot of the luminaries who had left the SPD in the teens and early 20s, like Kautsky and stuff, to go back into the SPD. Also, the SPD was in power. So kind of like, you know, how a lot of the left Mensheviks went back into the Bolsheviks. It was like a little bit of opportunism and a little bit of principled opposition. You know, they're like, oh, we can be whatever faction in this group. So in the big period of inflation, he actually serves as a German finance minister in 1923. And he starts to stabilize the currency, but he can't stop inflation altogether. He just slows it down. So he steps down and leads to Schacht. Now, Schacht is the guy who's kind of a proto-Keynesian with the early kind of centrist Nazis actually based their monetary policy off of. So, but he resigned before the Schachtian monetary reforms took place. So he actually does serve briefly as the finance minister for the SPD. He goes back to doing theoretical writing. And in 1925, he formulates the Heidelberg program, which becomes the SPD's platform. And he's appointed again as the SPD's finance minister.
When he is working within the government inside the SPD and as a finance minister, has he at that point abandoned the idea that the only way to achieve socialism ultimately would be a revolutionary transformation of society?
Yes. So he's picked up some Bernsteinian ideas.
Yeah, okay. And when does that happen? And was it in his original work on monopoly capital?
No, but he builds on that. So his original work on monopoly capital sees that capitalism is going to have a centralizing characteristic, that crisis is going to basically reset it but lead to further centralizations each round. And he thinks this is going to lead to like major geopolitical disaster, which he's basically right on. That's who Lenin's picking up, like formalizing Lenin and Bukharin formalize that in the theory of imperialism. But sometime between 1918 and 1924, as he gets closer and closer to the government, he starts seeing that monopoly capital tendency in the development of transnational firms as a way to get past the nation state.
Hmm. He becomes a neoliberal.
Kind of. in a way, yes. In a way, you have a similar problem to what happens with, like, say, the Labor Party in the mid-70s. And he starts thinking, like, all we need to do is to help capital develop. We need to get protections for the workers as best we can so that we can keep them into the party and with immediate reforms. This actually leads to Lenin. This is when Lenin really hunkered. This time period is when Lenin really hunkers down on his trade union consciousness stuff, too.
Now, what's the connection there? Explain what you mean by that. Was Lenin being influenced to be more critical of the trade union consciousness because he's against Hilferding?
Well, he's against the social democrats in general, and the blood is getting, you know, worse and worse. And Hilferding had...
These guys who want to support capital and just give the workers some reforms and, you know, some higher wages and vacations and all that kind of thing to keep them within the party, they're our enemies.
Right.
Not just because theoretically they are our enemies, but they opposed the October Revolution.
Right.
And they had Rosa killed.
Yeah. Exactly. Even though the primary theorist was actually on Rosa's side in the November Revolution. So, like, it's a mess. As you can see, that's why I was jumping back and forth from the timeline, because some of the things that happen are relevant to things that happen later. So, but he starts seeing this. Basically, the theorists of the SPD start seeing Kautsky and Hilferding start seeing, like, oh, all we need to do is to get mass enfranchisement, get these international firms to develop and centralize teleologically. That means we can do the teleological planning that the Soviet Union was trying to do without the authoritarianism.
Now, what do you mean teleologically? You mean...
It means centralized production, where everything in the system is centralized and can move out and really, really...
So the teleological just means that there's a center.
It's a center, and the center has a plan. The plan has a specific goal. That goal...
These are transnational corporations or, you know, forms of capital... Why would enfranchisement help?
He thinks eventually if you have universal enfranchisement in enough countries, you can seize control of these by state fiat.
So once the state seizes control, then you've got nationalist formations around these capitals, centers of capital.
Yeah, it's a problem.
I mean, that's sort of, you can see that dilemma playing out in the anti-globalization movement.
Exactly.
And in Brexit.
Yeah.
Because what you're trying to do is the left wing reason to be pro Brexit would be to give the state more control over capital.
Right.
But the reason people on the left are completely allergic to that is because they're concerned about nationalization, about the nation state's tendency to become imperialistic and go to war with one another.
Yep. And so this leads to all sorts of problems. One of the things is, like, so Hilferding had opposed the SPD crackdown on the Sparks and, you know, the proto-KPD, the proto-German Communist Party, in 1913, but he is silent on it when they do it again in 1929, because he's the finance minister. And I said Schacht replaces him in 1929. In 1929, when he was assigned as minister for the second time, he gets hit by the Great Depression. So he's part of that group then. I mean, he's actually, you know, at one point part of the government that starts saying, okay, we're going to do lesser evilism. We're going to make concessions to the conservatives for two reasons. One is the theory of monopoly capital. We got to develop this capital, get it more centralized, get it more organized, so we can seize its entire operation. And the other is... the Nazis are scary. The conservatives are not quite as scary. Let's try to work with the conservatives. Now, he's not a leader on that. I mean, he's not a high-level political functionary beyond economics. But he's in the party when that happens.
Now, I mean, just to go back to this, I know we just asked, we just went through this, but at that point, what did he think seizing this transnational capital would mean? And wouldn't that in itself be an authoritarian move in the terms of liberal democracy that he was a part of?
Yes, it would have been. I think he would consider authoritarian, but democratically authoritarian, because most of the population in the areas of capital were proletariat, and it would have been elected in.
Yeah, but you would have to get the if it's a transnational corporation, you'd have to get, and that's servicing and providing goods to more than one nationality, more than one nation, you'd have to get votes in more than one nation.
Yeah.
How would that for it to be democratic?
Well, he was part of it. Remember, he was part of the Second International. So, you know, the Socialist International at the time he's part of the First International, and they flirted with the Second International. So at the time, the idea was to use international coordination to seize it.
So in other words, his friends in other nations would also seize control of.
Yeah, you know, as soon as it happened in one country, and the proletariat hit with full enfranchisement, tribes that realized they would do it, it would spring off in other areas. Snap, 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 and you know that's how it would happen.
So it's kind of a revolutionary move, only through state.
Right. It's revolutionary without insurrection. Ideally, basically, if you've read the right wing Austrian Schuppender, who thought. I mean, his theory was that they were going to do this in the guise of democracy. That was what was going to lead to socialism, is increase enfranchisement, welfare programs, bam, socialism. That's why Schuppender, who was a right-winger and aligned with von Borik and whatnot, was very popular with social democrats in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, because, you know, his critique was like what they actually thought they were going to be able to do.
This man was the first to understand how capitalism really works. Joseph Alois Schumpeter.
He's without question one of the greatest and most original of economists.
Schumpeter is probably the only economist who really, really saw innovation as the driver.
My iPhone is the virtual embodiment of the idea of creative destruction that Schumpeter wrote about.
But Apple is just one example that shows how innovation can change the world.
Any industry that delivers poor service for a high price deserves to be disrupted.
Every technological revolution takes the whole economy up to a new level of productivity by transforming everything.
It's a vision that had only a few advocates at the beginning.
For a century and a half, only two figures focused centrally on the process of innovation as a driver of growth. And these were Karl Marx and Schumpeter.
At the same time, he was an eccentric and erratic individual.
He was a showman.
He always made it clear that he came from somewhere else.
Schumpeter went around in carriages in Vienna with changing prostitutes, for example. He behaved improperly for ordinary bankers.
This film tells the life of a genius and puts his achievements into the context of today's most burning questions.
Before them was always chaos, dark, and now there is light and truth and lots and lots and lots of money.
They start dividing up, you know, because of their continued suppression in 1919 and 1929 of the communists, the increased, the fact that they relied on labor unions, which largely required you to be employed to pay dues, and there was an increased mass amount of unemployment, the Communist Party had increasingly picked up the unemployed. And so there was a massive division. Because the Communist Party, though, was not as willing to make concessions to the state, the Communist Party actually had people out to fight the fascists in the street in the mass mobilizations. However, they were constantly being suppressed by alliances of the Social Democrats and the Conservatives, which of course bleeds the blood. At this time period, Stalin takes third positionism.
Okay, wait, let's pause for a second. I want to go back and ask you a question about this idea of seizing the capital some more, just a little bit more. One is, had they at that point abandoned some of the, like had this idea of there being an early Marx and a late Marx taken hold, or had they abandoned, also to what extent had they abandoned the idea that of exploitation being a problem, or, you know, because from the point of view of the Marxists who I've been thinking about this afternoon, one of the problems with the post-World War II era was that even when it was very efficient, it was dehumanizing, right? You weren't allowing the working class to actually realize freedom through these state monopolies. Even if you didn't think that there was going to be massive unemployment and privation, people were becoming like machines, right? Appendages to machines was the other critique. Was there any concern about that?
Hilfer didn't seem to have assumed, like Kowski, that the increased need for skills within industrialization would lead to an increasingly educated populace and increased technology to reduce work hours.
Okay, so basically we would all just, you know, be the it would be like the gig economy kind of vision.
Right, except that the state, you know, would be gig economy with like UBI, but UBI would not be sucky UBI. You know, like...
Right.
It would be universal employment, but very low hours and highly skilled for most people, you know, so it'd be...
Right. It would be basically the man, just maybe everyone would become a bureaucrat. Every man is, instead of his own king, every man his own bureaucrat.
You kind of get the feeling that towards the end, well, you know, they took the Marx thing about administrating things to a kind of technocratic conclusion. Like, all we got to do is administer stuff. So we just need, you know, everybody's going to do a little bit of labor and a lot of bureaucracy, and then they'll have, like, you know, 13 hours a day to do whatever.
Right. But they must have given up on the idea of the declining rate of profit at this point.
Well, no, actually, they thought the declining rate of profit was driving the business cycle. They thought if they could assume control of production and plan it, they could do away with it.
Or if not do away with it, ride it like it's a wave or something.
Right. Like, but, you know, they weren't actually as big into, like, monetary schemes and stuff as, like, Social Democrats would later become.
Okay.
That was actually more of a fascist thing, frankly. I mean, like I said, one of Hilferding's major things to do is when they tried to use currency schemes in the early 20s, to really do that, and inflation got out of control, is he actually slowed down inflation. He didn't stop it, though. He wasn't one of these people who thought that liquidity equals value. So in that sense, he was different from the early 20s Social Democrats and from, like, say, Mitterrand in France, our early 70s New Labour, where they tried to basically use currency schemes to get out of neoliberalizing.
And or what Bernie Sanders would have been if he got elected, probably.
Correct. But they still thought organized capital and the central organization of capital and capitalist planning would lead to, all you need to do is seize those mechanisms. You know, and everyone from Pearl Harvey to Lee Phillips has said similar things. Like, it's a common belief now.
Right.
So it doesn't seem so wildly out of, you know, I think a lot of people still, I mean, I even think a lot of communists still kind of think this, like, that capitalist production is controllable. All you need to do is democratize it and then centralize it and plan it.
Why even bother with the democratizing it? I mean, really, because... What's the assumption behind the need for democratizing it?
Because every man is involved in the decisions of the state. They're not, you know, they have say into how development goes.
Then why do you need centralization?
For efficiency's
sake.
Well,
but wait. So basically democracy is a sham then, because what you're saying is you need the buy-in of democracy. But you need a meritocratic set of best men who can figure out the math to manage this thing properly.
Well, one gets the feeling that actually eventually that they really did think that that would eventually be everybody, but in the transition period where they seize power.
Everyone would be trained up really, really well.
That's the essential assumption. That's the assumption that Kowski and Hilferding have that does not carry into the late 40s. Like, you know, you don't see that in Adorno or Horkheimer or Castoriadis or any of them. And the reason why is, one, I don't think anyone really thought about what specialization was going to do. Like, that you could be super so specialized that your general skills would drop precipitously. And two, I don't think they thought you could automate, that automation would lead to more complexity across the board.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think they thought that automation would lead to, like, making it easy, like making the worker less skilled in ways that you see in, like, the U.S. service sector.
Right. Yeah. And well, the reason why I ask about the assumption with democracy, on the one hand, it seemed like it was that you get the best people through democratic participation.
Right.
That you wouldn't get, you wouldn't have this nepotism decide things. You wouldn't have, you would actually get a meritocratic ruling elite through democracy. Was kind mm-hmm. of the idea. But on the other, if you believe that the democracy can get you the best people, then why bother with getting a big set of representational, you know, leaders? Why not just let everybody make these decisions? And then what you're saying is, well, that is the end goal. The end goal is to make everyone qualified to manage their little sector of the capitalist society.
Right.
But it's still based on this kind of production.
Yeah. So it's interesting how seemingly, one, you just see these guys get, the closer they get, the more that they are involved in the affairs of the German state, the more they compromise themselves, the more they compromise themselves in the case of Hilferding. You can just see the trajectory. All right. It kills him. He dies in 1941 because the Gestapo kidnap him abroad. And while they've never admitted that they killed him, pretty much everyone agrees they killed him. They weren't even willing to risk putting him in a concentration camp for political prisoners. He's, you know, off. They also use him, by the way, as part of their Judeo-Bolshevik conspiracies because he's Jewish.
Right.
You know, the whole blaming both capitalism and socialism on the Jews, he was a key figure they used for that.
Mm-hmm.
But in the third, I mean, so he goes into exile in, let's see, I think in like 1932, after his party, he's out of the government by 1929, but his party makes the deal with the conservative chancellor to appease Hitler and to stop what had happened about the fascist in Austria where they had assassinated a conservative leader. I'm not quite sure actually that happened before or after, but that did happen. And so there was legit fears of this. They give power straight over to the Nazis. So he goes into exile. Because of this whole monopoly capital theory, they had not encouraged workers to really resist. That had been the role of the communists. Because the communists saw them as quote unquote, kissing cousins to fascism and social fascists, who because they would not oppose capital and fascism was at the highest state of capital, that the social democrats were thus complicit, they would not join together. If they had joined together, they actually would have had enough votes to had control things in 1922. And there were attempts in small municipalities for workers' parties the remnants of the United of the Independent Social Democratic Party and the Communist parties and the Social Democratic Party to all come together, but it only like took them like two or three municipalities.
Now, what did they mean by saying opposing capital at that in that moment? In 1932.
Well, they had said that in failing to oppose capital, because they were willing to work with capitalism's development under their understanding of the monopoly capital theory, which Lenin and Bukharin and whatnot had taken into the Bolsheviks, but they had used it to explain geopolitical stuff and had not obviously gone this way about the development of capital. In fact, they thought that it was going to lead to more and more inter-capitalist wars,
right,
indefinitely. And what it actually leads to is, something kind of, I think that resembles, although it isn't quite the same thing as what Kalski predicted in the teens,
but did Lenin abandon the idea of a terminal crisis?
Lenin doesn't really talk about that stuff as much after that. Like, when he actually got, you have, at the point this is all happening, you got 1919, 1920, you begin the Russian Civil War. That goes for, 4 years?
Yeah.
3 years, and then he's dead.
Yeah.
So Lenin's not really thinking about the international situation, or he's not in dialogue with the international situation as much, and also, except through the formal communist parties. And by the time you get to the 30s, they've been thoroughly Bolshevized. They banned factions. So these groups could not come in to the communist parties as dissenting factions.
Don't you have to believe, though, that there won't be a terminal cataclysmic crisis in capital in order to believe that you can just write it as a series of business cycles that'll... Because that's...
Well, they all assumed that monopoly capital was true and that the monopolization through finance was a result of the first phase of capital. But they thought that the second phase of capital through finance capital would change that. Lenin thought that was because it could be stabilized almost indefinitely through imperialism. And the Social Democrats thought it was increasingly stabilized through the organization and centralization of capital.
So the difference between them was that Lenin thought that a few imperialist nations would dominate the rest of the world, whereas the Social Democrats in Germany under Hilferding,
and Kalski
thought that what would happen is that there would become that all nations' boats would rise through as capital concentrated across national boundaries.
Right. I mean, they kind of took the early First International position that Marx later abandons, that colonialization was actually spreading modernity through the world and thus was good.
Right.
So they did believe in autonomy for these regions and whatnot, but they weren't opposed to capital going there.
So political autonomy, but transnational capital.
Correct.
So in a way, again, that sounds a little bit from our perspective today like neoliberalism.
Kinda, yeah. I mean,
with the state spending to support capital investment.
Correct.
Yeah,
yeah,
and to probably what they would want more spending on workers, in terms of wage guarantees and that kind of thing. The old first internationalists, but okay. So, but the difference was that the Marxists believed that ultimately you were going to have a revolutionary break.
Right.
And the Bernsteinist didn't think that was necessary.
Right. And in Hilferding, you get something like an attempt at a synthesis of those views. There is a revolutionary break, but it's totally democratic. And there might be violence, but only in response. And
oh, so that moment when the state takes over the capital and starts to rationally plan it. But see, Marx didn't think that it was going to be a matter of rationally planning the way that these capitals form, you know, these corporations or whatever were working. He thought that the workers were going to have to overthrow that and change the mode of production.
Right. So what you have in this is a not so much what you have is a failure to understand the difference in modes of production and what we could call the kind of organizational, or if you want to use the technical philosophical term, the teleological orientation of capital.
But it doesn't sound like they'd abandoned value theory altogether.
No, they had not. But they had they weren't taking it to its full implication. I mean, arguably nobody was, right? Except for maybe like the left communists. And by the time the fascists really come up, and when things are really disarray, when the SPD goes into exile, and like after 32, they put out something called the Prague Manifesto. And they start talking about, opposition to capital, and they kind of start dropping the monopoly capital theory that they were operating under in the late 20s, early 30s. And they start listening to the right opposition communists, which were Bakarinist in Germany, and the left opposition, which are the proto-Trotskyists. And they start taking, the United Front policy, which is flipped, which is not adopted in its popular front form, by the official Communist parties until the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact is broken when Hitler invades Russia. And then the communists worldwide finally adopt the United Front, saying they'd work with bourgeois parties, including, social democrats and other liberal parties.
Now, when they do that, have they at that point abandoned the idea of building up towards revolution?
No, it's seen as a tactical necessity, and that you could.
But I mean, in that moment, was it seen as a retreat?
I think it was seen as a course correction geopolitically. People are thinking more in terms of value theory and development than they actually are.
Because they were only thinking about this in terms of basically whether or not this party inside Germany or that party inside France or I'm just saying that at random, right. France, but really like whether or not the Soviet Union was going to expand its power.
Right, with these ostensible satellite parties who were then working with these bourgeois factions to fight the fascists, because fighting fascists became important after the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact failed. Interestingly enough, though, one of the reasons why the left opposition – it didn't really stay opposed to fascism is because Trotsky actually agreed tactically with the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, even though he thought that Stalin's understanding of fascism was wrong, because he thought that fascism was so incoherent it would collapse on its own, which it probably would have, except they were going to war with everybody. So, right.
But my question regarding the United Front, again, just to go back to that for a second, is that what is basically whether or not at that point Stalin had accepted, had made everyone accept the idea of socialism in one country?
Sort of, yeah. I mean, Stalin's socialism in one country stuff is confusing to me because he never completely abandons internationalism ever.
Uh-huh. Right.
But he does get, he does start like, he does like do more and more like if we just develop socialism in Russia and the other Soviet satellite states, that'll be enough that we can expand it later, which since they're cut off, and it leads to what happens in you know, actually, at least what happens in all these states where they eventually have to buy back into the circuit of capital. Like, I mean, honestly, one of the reasons why the Soviet Union fell is even before Perestroika, they were having to participate more and more in the international market with their three currency schemes and all that to do anything. Like,
yeah.
And they were exhausting their national resources in like places like Azerbaijan. So,
well, listen, have you gotten to the end of the story on the failure?
I've gotten to the end of the story about, you know, thinking the political consequences of thinking you can control capital. Because yeah. One of the things that they kept on doing because they believed this, they kept on siding with both lesser evilism and also like they would make what they saw as temporary concessions to austerity.
Yeah.
And they did that to develop capital. And of course that loses their worker base. And also since they're politically antagonizing their more radical elements, there's no way for in Germany, the communists and the social democrats to reconcile over the initial, violences over 1918, which you would have think someone like Kilfording would have been able to do because from the communist perspective, he was on the right side.
We've been talking for 50 minutes and we'll do a second hour. And the second hour will be on the stuff that I was thinking about this afternoon. It'll be more loose, but this was really interesting. And I actually will probably go over this again. And we might talk about this again, but the next time we talk, let's talk about socialism in one country.
Yeah, let's do that. Okay.